Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Abraham Lincoln was not woke, according to the standards of the 1619 Project. He genuinely hated slavery, and he was also a politician, so he had to temper his remarks about emancipation and so forth, and he understood his audience. In terms of a man of his time, he was far ahead. He was limited in what he could do as a politician and especially as a president.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. There have been a number of heated debates about America's history in the past few years. Should statues of Robert E. Lee come down? Should we rename public schools if they're named after somebody who has done or said controversial things by our standards? Should we cancel Columbus Day? But I would argue, by far, the most contentious debate over history comes from the New York Times 1619 Project. This was released in 2019, and it was a collection of articles that, quote, aims to reframe the country's history by placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of the United States' national narrative. It was led by journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones and a number of contributors, and the project claimed that the United States is fundamentally and irrevocably racist, that slavery, not the Constitution or 1776, are at the core of American identity. So slavery wasn't a blemish that the founders grudgingly tolerated with the understanding that it would eventually disappear, but it was something the Constitution and the Revolution itself went out of its way to secure and protect. So specific claims of the 1619 Project were that the Revolutionary War was fought above all to preserve slavery, not independence. Second, that capitalism came from the plantation. And third, that modern features of American society like traffic jams or affinity for sugar are connected to slavery and segregation. Now, the 1619 Project received widespread condemnation by historians, both on the left and the right. Princeton historian Alan Guelzo called it a conspiracy theory. Quote, the 1619 Project isn't history, it's a conspiracy theory. And like all conspiracy theories, the 1619 Project announces with a eureka that it has acquired the explanation for everything. Fellow Princeton historian Sean Willens circulated a letter objecting to the project, and it acquired signatories like James McPherson, Gordon Wood, Victoria Bynum, and James Oakes, all who are leading scholars in the field of the American Revolution and American history, who objected to the very basic factual inaccuracies of the project. Now, despite these inaccuracies, the project spread like wildfire. Nicole Hannah-Jones won a Pulitzer Prize in 2020 for commentary. Hundreds of newspapers endorsed it, and it didn't receive backing in the historical academic sphere, but it did in the political sphere. And I would say most concerning, public schools began incorporating the 1619 Project into their school curricula. The Pulitzer Center helped turn it into a curriculum that's now taught in more than 4,500 schools across the nation. Well, today's guest is Dr. Mary Graber, author of the book Debunking the 1619 Project, Exposing the Plan to Divide America. She looks at the central claims of the project, which I outlined here, And then shows one by one how, while it might make sense in passing, historically it's completely unfounded. Now, listeners, I should say that this episode is different from episodes that I've done before because I'm sort of taking off my interview hat here and there and putting on my editorial hat. That's because I'm endorsing the arguments of this author and joining her in denouncing the 1619 Project. Now, I almost never do this because I don't want to tell you, the listener, how to think. Rather, I try to do my best to let a guest present his or her arguments and let them make their case as best as possible. And if I can help make the argument clear, play devil's advocate once in a while or provide context. But ultimately, I want to provide you the best historical raw material so that you, the audience, can be the judge. Now, here I'm making an exception with the 1619 Project because I think the arguments of it are so poorly constructed and so heavily politicized that they don't deserve the dignity of being taken seriously. Now, normally I would just simply ignore such poorly crafted arguments in the same way that I don't have a guest on my show who argues that aliens built the pyramids or that the HMS Titanic was sunk by a German U-boat. And honestly, I place the 1619 Project in the same sphere as those arguments because I think that the arguments are so ahistorical in nature and so poorly sourced that they are really only as widespread as they are due to political compatriots agreeing with them. But the reason I'm mentioning it on this episode is because the 1619 Project, as I mentioned earlier, does have widespread support. The arguments are seeping into public school curricula, and many people are accepting the arguments without actually looking on whether or not they're properly historically sourced. Now, you don't have to agree, of course, with everything Mary Graber says in this episode, but in the show notes, I'm going to provide other sources here that I think do a good job demonstrating the problems of the 1619 Project. They include the 1776 Project PAC and 1776 Unites, which I'll include links in the show notes. But as I'll say later on in this interview, the reason I object to it so much is I see in real time a historical argument that has gotten widespread public support. But really, I think it's just a dangerous historical inaccuracy that if too many people believe is going to cause problems and even damage to our social fabric. Anyway, that's all I have to say. I wanted to include that disclaimer because this episode, as I noted, is different than others. So there's a lot to unpack in this episode, obviously. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Mary Graber. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, well, we have our work cut out for us this episode. As I said in my prologue, I normally don't editorialize like this, but I don't like the 1619 Project, so I'm glad you can be here to unpack this a lot more. So let's start at the beginning for listeners who either haven't read it in the New York Times or don't know about it, or maybe they've heard this year thrown around 1619, but they don't know what's actually behind that. So in a nutshell, could you explain to me and to the listeners the main claims of the 1619 Project in the words of the principal author, Nicole Hannah-Jones?
Yeah, well, the 1619 Project basically aims to replace the year 1776 as our founding with the year 1619, when it is claimed that slavery began here, and slavery is the foundation. It forms the bedrock principles of our country. And that indeed it was not founded as a democracy or a constitutional republic, but as a slaveocracy. And that is the word that is used in the lead essay. So basically, all the claims made about the founding are false. They were made by hypocrites. And the founding itself was made in order to perpetuate slavery. We declared independence to perpetuate slavery. And since white America has profited from slavery and from slaves' descendants, and we see the effects to this day in disparities in income and health and education and so forth, and all of this can be traced back to the institution of slavery upon which this country was founded. And in order to rectify these wrongs, we need reparations and we need to move far, far left in our politics in order to bring about a truly just society.
Okay, so those are the main points. Now, I want to dig in specifically into the year 1619 to say what actually happened, because this is how the article series opens, where I believe Nicole Hannah Jones is saying that she learned that this is the arrival of the first Africans to the colonies. But first, can you say, based on what we know, according to historical evidence, what actually happened in 1619, and how significant were these events in the grand scheme of American history? Because the article series makes a point that you can draw a direct line from 1619 to 2021. But based on what we know of historical evidence, how important was this year and the events therein?
Well, so in August of 1619, the colonists in Jamestown were somewhat surprised when the ship, the White Lion, came to port. It carried a number of Africans that had been captured from a Portuguese slaver and attacked, and they had been taken off of that ship. It had been going to Veracruz, Mexico, from Africa, from Angola, and here it arrived, and they needed food, and so they exchanged these Africans. They say 20 and some odd. They keep the number vague. So they exchanged them for food. As far as we know, these people, these Africans, were slaves on the ship. What their exact status was once they came to Jamestown, we are not sure. Slavery had not really been established in the colonies, but we do know that they were under servitude, just like the indentured servants that were working in the tobacco fields and basically work side by side with them. The first legal case of slavery, of a legal right to own a slave, was actually established by one of those original Africans by the name of Anthony Johnson, who had earned his freedom and had acquired some land and at least one slave by the name of John Kasor, who was suing for his freedom. John Kasor, an African, had the help of two white brothers. But Anthony Johnson, the slave owner, the African slave owner, won the case. And as far as we know, that is the first legal precedent in Jamestown for slavery. And from then on, the slave laws became codified. It was illegal to enslave white people, although they were indentures, but you could not enslave them. But blacks did enslave other blacks. But eventually, slavery became associated with black people. Laws were established whereby a slave woman's child was automatically enslaved. Rights were increasingly restricted. And so by the end of the 17th century, we start to see slavery as we think of it historically. But throughout the 17th century, that was not the case. It evolved slowly.
And for listeners who want a lot more background context, a few years ago, I did a 5-part series on slavery from the ancient world and essentially the beginning of civilization to abolition and different places around the world in which it took place. Something I was interested to learn, and I'm sure you could speak more to this, is that the first slaves in the New World were white. They were purchased in the Mediterranean slave markets, and the word slave itself comes from the word Slav, meaning that people from Eastern Europe and Slavic peoples were those found and sold in these slave markets. And the slaves, many slaves in the New World, especially on Caribbean plantations, were white Slavs. Is this still happening in the early 1600s?
Yeah, the Muslims from Northern Africa, the Barbary pirates during Jefferson's term, were still enslaving white captives. And it was Thomas Jefferson as president who put an end to that with sending the Marines in. So white slavery was, yes, still going on. In Russia, you had the serfs who were in effect slaves. They were not freed. The peasants were not freed until 1861. And so you did still have white people who were enslaved, not here in the colonies, but in other places.
So the one of the main points of the 1619 Project, I mean, it establishes this year, and you elucidated what happens then, but then it ties this to events that happen centuries later. Probably the most controversial claim of the essay, at least among historians, is that the Revolutionary War was fought specifically to preserve slavery. And this claim has gotten pushback, not just historians on the right, but also historians on the left. Interestingly, I think one of the first pushbacks against this were from a socialist periodical that wanted to frame conflict in terms of class, not in terms of race. But can you describe the claims of the 1619 Project with the fighting, what it says about the Revolutionary War, and then what you would say to this in response, that how you disagree?
Yeah, it's a claim that really just comes out of left field. And it was originally worded to say that a primary reason for declaring independence was to protect slavery, because the founders were worried that the British were going to abolish slavery. At this time, the British were the dominant slave trading power, and there was pushback from some of the colonies about them imposing slaves onto them. Some of them were acting out of motives in sympathy with the slaves. They wanted to abolish slaves. Some of them said, we have too many slaves. And the long passage that was excised from Jefferson's original Declaration of Independence spoke to that. So all indicators are that slavery was just something that was on the side. It was an accepted practice. It did not really have anything to do with declaring independence. The taxes and the increasing oppression in other ways were the reasons, not slavery. I mean, the fighting had started before Dunmore's proclamation. And so it was a statement that just, I think, required the response of even a leftist historian like Sean Wilentz, because it's so outrageous. I think he was one of the, besides the World Socialist Organization that you had referenced, he was one of the first ones to object to that claim. So, but it's all part and parcel of this overriding thesis that everything had to do with slavery.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
This is me taking off my interviewer hat and sort of the editorial hat, but it's really frustrating because, I mean, Britain wasn't fighting for abolition. An abolitionist position was very much an elite thing. It's something that Benjamin Franklin believed in, but it's not abolished in the British Empire until decades later. It's something that, like you said, is incidental to the founding fathers. And the British use the promise of emancipation to slaves, but really only as a tool and as a wedge issue amongst slaves or black residents of the colonies if they join the British side. And their numbers are quickly overwhelmed. But could you speak to how the founding fathers were trained to thread this issue of slavery? Because this is a very important thing. And I mean, it is a nuanced issue, like Thomas Jefferson, of course, famously owning slaves, and other founding fathers as well. But they understand the complexity of this issue. They're trying to figure out how to sunset it. Jefferson with a Northwest Ordinance, not allowing slaves in different territories. Jefferson talking about it, it's like grabbing a wolf by the ear. So can you speak to how the founding fathers were trained to work through this issue? And of course, they weren't, not all of them were saints on this particular regard, but they were doing their best in the 18th century. But anyway, I don't want to steal your thunder. So how would you describe this to a layman who doesn't know the issues of how the founding fathers were dealing with the issue of slavery in the 18th century?
Yeah, well, a good number, I think about a third of them, were abolitionists in some way and didn't own slaves. But the majority did. And I think a good illustration is Thomas Jefferson. And I focus on him in debunking the 1619 Project because he is attacked. There are two main figures that are attacked, as I see it, Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln. And Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, has traditionally been known as the apostle of liberty, is instead cast as someone who relishes slavery, wants to work slaves to death in slave labor camps. I mean, the terminology, the language is very incendiary. It evokes Nazi concentration camps. But Jefferson, he was born into a wealthy family. He was born into the gentry. His earliest memory is of being carried on horseback by a trusted slave when he was 2 or 3 years old. One of the claims that the 1619 Project makes is that black slaves were seen as subhuman. And my counter to that is, would you trust your 2 or 3 year old on horseback with a subhuman? But that is Jefferson's earliest memory. His father died when he was 14 years old. He went to William and Mary, and when he came back, he was given his part of the land. He was also given the responsibility of taking care of his mother's properties, and he was given the responsibility of taking care of these people. It wasn't like he could say, no, I don't want to deal with them. Go off and get a job, which is the way the 1619 Project naively presents it. The laws for manumission were very strict in Virginia. The freed slaves had to leave the state. The owners had to guarantee that they would not become wards of the state. They had to put up bonds. If they moved someplace, they could be re-enslaved. There were kidnappers all around. It was a very complicated situation for someone like Jefferson. And you mentioned the Northwest Territories, and then he rethought that. And then later in life, he adopted this idea of diffusionism. He thought that if slavery were spread far and wide, it would eventually die out of its own accord. But he did try to introduce some measures. He looked at the older statesmen, what happened to them when they did propose limiting slavery. They got pushback. There was a backlash. They dug in their heels, and things actually became worse for the cause of freeing the slaves. So he understood his power and role as a statesman, and he knew he had to tread very carefully to not alarm the slave interests. As a matter of fact, he politically caught a lot of flack from the slave-owning interests for writing on behalf of the black scientist Benjamin Banneker or saying anything good about blacks. And so that was the situation he was in. And I go into an incident with the secretary to President James Madison Edward Coles, a young idealistic man who encouraged the 71-year-old Jefferson to go out and agitate for emancipation. And I describe what happened to Edward Coles when he tried to do it. He came up against the hard brick wall of reality.
Right. And somebody who I've spoken to on this past issue is Clay Jenkinson, who's the host of a program called the Thomas Jefferson Radio Hour. And he's done things in the past where he tried to answer questions from listeners and others in the character of Jefferson. So how would Jefferson speak to contemporary things like space exploration or whatnot? And the issue of him and race has come up frequently. And what he said is that if Jefferson were in a time machine and came to today, he would say things that we wouldn't find acceptable in polite company in the 21st century. So that's clear. I mean, it's hard to expect much otherwise from a person from the 18th century. But in terms of the change that he evoked in his society, sort of the delta, the change in position from where it was to where it was able to go, he pulled things up considerably. Now, did he arrive at the...
Abraham Lincoln was not woke, according to the standards of the 1619 Project. He genuinely hated slavery, and he was also a politician. So he had to temper his remarks about emancipation and so forth. And he understood his audience. He maybe did not think of Blacks as being socially equal 100%, but in terms of a man of his time, he was far ahead. He was limited in what he could do as a politician and especially as a president. He adhered to the Constitution. He knew he could not, if he abided by the Constitution, just simply free the slaves with an order. Frederick Douglass thought he could, but Abraham Lincoln, of course, was trying to adhere to the Constitution. He was trying to prevent a war. And not recognizing those limitations, the lead writer of the 1619 Project claims that he had absolutely no desire to end slavery, that he wanted to ship off all the Blacks. She kind of leaps over the Frederick Douglass debates, the election, his early career, and goes to this meeting in 1862 where Lincoln meets with five Black men about colonization. And she describes the scene. She takes some liberties and she says he was hovering over them. You know, he was very tall, 6'4", but that he was menacing them. I have not read any accounts that are like that of that meeting, but it was being done for political reasons. He had a reporter there. It was deliberately set up so that it would be advertised. It was a preliminary to the Emancipation Proclamation. As a matter of fact, John Hope Franklin, whom I cite, he wrote a very good book on the Emancipation Proclamation. He said that you could tell that Lincoln was getting closer and closer to the Emancipation Proclamation by how much he talked about colonization. So this was a political strategy that Nicole Hannah Jones does not recognize. She doesn't recognize that some of the places that Lincoln was thinking of were in what is present-day Panama, that he only wanted a few to go, and that this would, even a small settlement, would assuage those, the Southerners, and make them less resistant about emancipating slaves. So this was a tactic. She doesn't understand it. And she chooses to present it as part of this overall thesis that this country is founded on the principles of slavery, that all white people are deep in their hearts enslavers or racists, that they have profited from slavery, that they refuse to make up for it, and that every single incident in history points back to that premise.
That's what's frustrating for me, because a lot of the debunking I've done on the show come from books, some of them written hundreds of years ago, that basically do what the 1619 Project does, where the author thinks of something, and then the author will sometimes fabricate entire scenes, or the end goal and the outcome is fixed. It's just recreating the events and the scenery and the cherry picking of data to get there. So something I've beat up a lot in the past is Washington Irving's biography of Christopher Columbus, of which the fallacious idea that medievals thought the world was flat comes from, because he fabricated the scene where Columbus is in the court of Ferdinand and Isabella and they think he'll fall off the edge of the earth. And monks are saying this. Nothing like that ever happened. No one has believed since. I mean, the most contemporary example is pagan Scandinavia of people who thought the world was flat. Before that, you have to go, before the ancient Greeks even find that. But Washington Irving wanted to tell a story and he needed villains. So he just fabricated this thing. And this thing keeps appearing over and over again. And I'm watching something like this happen in real time play out. So it's sort of like Nicole Hannah Jones just thought, well, I'm a journalist. I have no training as a historian whatsoever. But hey, when I was in school, I remember hearing this story about 1619. I'm going to just make up this thing, but I'm going to write it using mellifluous language. And also, could you speak to how she's had to backtrack some of the central claims of the project, that the Revolutionary War was fought because of slavery, where this was like a flag that was planted, but then her and her editor stealth edited stuff and she walked back stuff on Twitter. But so can you speak to that? And then how, I don't know, that argument that's ensued, just because I think this is important to show how flimsy and rickety the arguments are.
Yeah. So in the dead of night, sometime on the website, the New York Times said that some of the colonists wanted independence to protect slavery. Well, yeah, technically that could be true. So you have two people, maybe, and it's technically true, but it's not historically accurate. She likes to argue on Twitter, and I don't know if you follow her Twitter feed, but whenever there's a criticism, she comes out and usually in a very insulting manner, hits back against it. So she switches from claiming that the 1619 Project is truth and that it's facts to it's a narrative or it's journalism. And then she says, we weren't really saying that our country was founded in 16. We were saying, what if we considered it as if it were a hypothetical? But then on the other hand, so it's very squishy. She's kind of going back and forth. So it depends on what day she's making a statement. She wants it both ways, to have this be this kind of journalistic exercise and creative writing, evoking these emotions. And it's an interesting in terms of a genre, because she does what identity politics wants you to do, which is to bring in your personal experience. So if you recall, she talks about her father and the flag and her grandparents and great-grandparents escaping from the South. And she merges that personal narrative in with history. Now, she had written a personal essay about her family, which I believe, what she said about her family, I believe. I'm not saying that there was no discrimination or anything. That would be fine. But this is being marketed as a curriculum in history to teach about the history of slavery to students beginning in kindergarten. So it is fact, or it's presented as fact, because it's part of the curriculum. It's not like these kids are learning creative writing. They're learning about the history of slavery and the history of their country.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.
That's something I do want to come back to at the end of this episode, that I would say perhaps some of the reason this essay series has gotten so much traction is because it speaks to what some people will intuit as being true, that, okay, there are after effects of what happened in the past that are affecting today. So how do we understand that tension? How do we explore the history of the United States in a way that can be restorative or give people something that perhaps they were denied a long time? So to a larger group of people, there's enough level of resonance that maybe they're willing to hear it out and overlook some of the factual errors that maybe they don't bother to go into and actually research on their own and find out if they did that. It's held together by duct tape and chicken wire and all this stuff, like a 57 Chevy in Havana, Cuba. And one more just digression on my side. So histories like this that are produced that have the end claim and the argument created first, and then the data and evidence is cherry-picked or fabricated after the fact. I mean, in my own field of Ottoman studies, it was beset for decades by people who just basically looked at Islamic theology and said, okay, this is how we understand the Ottoman Empire. And if we look at this, this is what they did. Well, that part of it is true, but many of the early sultans were completely illiterate for the first several generations. So they did things that defied Islamic theology because they couldn't read it. So they were just like, they would claim certain things, but then they would also just fight warfare and do their best. So it was only after the fact that historians came along and were able to look at a larger picture that we were able to have a better understanding of what happened. Sorry, listeners, if you've been on this podcast long enough, you know that this is my research field, so I'll tie it in where I can. So anyway, to come back to some of the main points of the book. Now, I noted at the beginning that the argument is flimsy of the 1619 Project. It really is up there with like ancient aliens constructing the pyramids or that German U-boat sunk the Titanic. It's highly spurious. And normally I wouldn't give heed to arguments like this. However, the 1619 Project has incredible institutional backing. It won a Pulitzer Prize. As you mentioned, it's being incorporated into the curricula of hundreds, if not thousands, of public schools. So why is there so much institutional backing to a historical argument that falls apart so easily?
That's an interesting question. I think it came along at the right time. Last summer, we had the riots in the wake of the death of George Floyd. And I've heard someone call them the pre-election riots. And there was this sense of fear as we went into the election. And Democratic mayors just stood aside, let them go on. So I think there was a political purpose there. What we're seeing is this woke ideology. People want to be woke. They want to think of themselves as being virtuous and understanding and in some way morally superior to others. So you had corporations like Apple and Coca-Cola. They're spending millions, if not billions, on employee training. They're giving money to Black Lives Matter. Some of this is just, I think, an attempt to keep people quiet and to be in the good graces so they're not protested against. But then I think there are true believers in the 1619 Project. I found this after I wrote my book, Debunking Howard Zinn. There are people who, no matter how much evidence you give them, how many footnotes, even if it's from people on their side of the political spectrum, will not believe you. They believe this narrative. And I think with the way history has been written since about the 1960s and the way textbooks have been written, the 1619 Project seems take it just one step further, just to be a little more sort of daring or innovative. And so it's a logical extension of history as we've been taught. So one of the things, you know, that I point out in debunking the 1619 Project is the fact that proportionally in the antebellum period, there were a third as many Black slave owners as there were white slave owners. Now, growing up, going to high school, I never learned that there were any Black slave owners. Most people haven't. But that's not mentioned because it disrupts that thesis. And of course, Marxist history is driven by a thesis rather than the evidence as well. And this is a neo-Marxist history.
The 1619 Project, it seems to be pushing back against a straw man that we're trying to, if they use the Mott and Bailey strategy and retreat from the argument that the Revolutionary War was fought to uphold slavery, the Motts or the Bailey, I forget which one is on the hill that is the keep, but whatever it is, what they retreat to is, well, we're trying to have a narrative history to push back against the idea of manifest destiny. I mean, which I would say you wouldn't have, I mean, when was the last time you found that in a typical textbook? The 1950s? I mean, it's been that type of view of history hasn't really been taught in a way for a very long period of time. That I think the challenges and the nuances and the ugly aspects of American history that deservedly should be understood properly, I don't believe that's been hidden from anyone for a very long period of time. But I would like to tie these things together and say, how do you think that you would teach American history that, I mean, yes, of course, we have to acknowledge that it began in the 18th century. There were people who were enslaved by birth due to their race, that understanding the people, the Booker T. Washingtons and their autobiographies that portray very challenging, I mean, and sometimes hellish things that they faced as they were trying to better their ways in life. Yet at the same time, there is a promise of liberty that allowed the conditions, the material conditions, the moral conditions of many people to improve over generations. If you were able to present a history, how would you do that to bring in those two sides of the story?
Yeah. So back when I was teaching college, the big buzzword was multiculturalism. And I think slavery needs to be taught in a multicultural way, the way that it was practiced since time immemorial by all cultures. And that when it came here and was sort of established gradually, it was part of what was going on across the globe. So students need to have a wider perspective. And they also need to be disabused of this idea that it was an exclusively white thing. By law, whites could not be enslaved. That's true. Only Blacks could be enslaved. But I have numerous instances that I dug up from doing my research in some of these old articles, like you mentioned, going back, some of these old journals, where those who had been manumitted, who had been established by their masters, given money, taught a profession, got established, and one of the first things they did is they bought slaves of their own. So these were slaves who were freed and then bought slaves. The way they treated their slaves varied as much as it did among white owners. Some white owners, Jefferson being among the better of them, tried to do what they could by them and treat them, keep families together, make sure their needs were met, they weren't overworked, and so forth. Others were incredibly cruel. You find the same thing. And I think what we need to do is to look at it as an institution that knew no racial bounds, and that if we look back on it with horror, we need to also recognize that it was not an exclusive so-called sin of one race, and to look at it that way. So in a way, when the 1619 Project claims that we're not teaching about history of slavery, I would agree. But I would disagree in the way that it's taught, because a significant part of it is just left out.
Okay, another thing too, well, I guess to wrap up this discussion, I mean, and there's a lot more we could discuss, but I think for people to educate themselves on this topic, the challenge is that, like we said, this is working its way into the curricula. It's becoming part of the nomenclature that slavery has existed in America for 400 years. This is a 400-year-old problem, all that. And it's borrowing some of the understanding, the terminology, and the framing of this project. What do you think is a way for people to educate themselves on the topic and then maybe dialogue with those about this topic? I mean, maybe recognizing the concerns that they have, recognizing some of the aspects and glimmers of this that could be true, but then also speaking to people's main concerns that would allow them to find resonance with this project, but maybe correct their understanding.
Yeah, well, that's what my book is intended to do. What I want to do is to provide the information that's being left out of the 1619 Project and to demonstrate the common humanity that we have. I think the goal of the 1619 Project is to divide people, especially between the races, and it does that at a very young age, which I think is extremely dangerous. It's abusive to kids to instill in them this suspicion of others based on their race. So I say, yes, definitely teach about slavery. I agree that it needs to be taught about, but it needs to be taught about in the context of world history and of how freedom and this notion of free labor is a relatively modern concept. That's what's really radical, is this notion of self-government, of equality, of opportunity, and of freedom. And I think we need to look back on our country's history and see how much farther we've come than most of the rest of the world in realizing those ideals. And kids need to look at what's going on in other countries, in Africa, in China, where there still is slavery. And I think there needs to be this context in which American history is placed in terms of what's going on across time and across the world.
Right. There's always a lot more to the story. So again, for listeners who want to check out your book and look at this in more detail, the name of the book is Debunking the 1619 Project, Exposing the Plan to Divide America. Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Carrington, the McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraza. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.